This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. As a black journalist in South Africa, my guest Rich Mkando has covered stories many white journalists would have had difficulty getting. Recently, he's been covering the violence in the townships, including Katlehong, where he lives. He's also been covering the peace process and has interviewed Nelson Mandela and F.W. de Klerk, who recently shared the Nobel Peace Prize. Mkando has written a new book called Reporting South Africa, and he's visiting the United States. He's a correspondent for the international news service Reuters. He formerly wrote for the South African paper The Star and for the now-defunct Rand Daily Mail. He was one of the first blacks to be admitted to a white South African college. Next April, he'll be able to vote for the very first time when South Africa holds its first ever multiracial elections. It's the beginning of a new era for South Africa, but Mkando writes that the death of apartheid has been greatly exaggerated. I asked him how much his day-to-day life has changed during the dismantling of apartheid.
It has changed a lot. I can move freely wherever I want to go. I can associate with whoever I want to associate with. I can book into any restaurant or any hotel and enjoy myself. I can have lunch with white colleagues or friends without any raising any eyebrows. And I can talk. Basically, I can do whatever I want to do. I can talk to white right-wingers who never wanted to speak to us before. I can interview anyone I want to interview.
Well, when you came into the studio, I was asking you about some of the photographs in your book, and I was thumbing through them and asking you if you'd taken these pictures or not. And they were pictures of a body that had been set on fire and was, by the time the photograph was taken, it was really half of a body.
That's right.
And there was a picture of somebody who had been beaten and was just kind of bleeding onto the floor.
That's right.
And a picture of another body. And what you said to me was, oh, this is nothing compared to what's happening now.
Yes.
What's happening now?
What's happening now is that the violence is more brutal, actually, rather than actually hack you and leave you to bleed. They make sure that they hack you into pieces. And they make sure that they leave you dead and they burn you and make sure that by the time they leave, you're finished. This is actually encouraged by the fact that there's nobody to help the victims. The police are not there. The soldiers are not there. So these guys have time. They really have time to make sure that you suffer. I can give you two examples, which I still actually wonder whether any right-thinking human being can do that, to spend the whole night at the cemetery exhuming a body, take it out of its coffin, then the next day go around the township dancing and chanting slogans, taking the body out of the coffin and then burning it again to make sure that it's finished. By the time we arrive at the place where this exhumed body had been finished, there were bones. Actually, part of it were ashes, so you couldn't identify the body anymore. So the guy had to be buried twice by the family. Now what happens to the family, the psychological effect of the family? What happens to the people around it? By the way, also 2 weeks ago before I came here, I came across a foot of a man near a rubbish dump. And I was so surprised, and I felt so bad. I went around the houses there, and I asked what happened. I really wanted to do a human interest story. I don't know whether we should call it a human interest story, but I wanted to do a human interest story about finding the foot of a man near a rubbish dump. And then I spoke to a couple of people around there, and they told me that the guy had was lying there for about 2 days, and eventually his body was eaten by dogs. And the only remaining thing is the foot.
What is this violence about in the townships now?
Well, it's about everything. It's about power, it's about territory, it's about revenge, it's about jealousy, it's about everything. It could have started as a fight for territory, but now it involves everything. It involves all social spheres of life. It's very difficult to know exactly. I have been in this business for 5 years now. That means covering what is going on in the township, in the townships. And every now and then I talk to many people, and they tell me different reasons why the things they think this has happened.
I think a lot of people suspect that there's perhaps some outside manipulation behind the fighting between the Inkatha Zulu movement and the ANC, the African National Congress. Do you feel that the fighting between those two groups is being manipulated by people who are sorry apartheid is ending?
Indeed. I said that earlier on that there are many factors that causes violence. There are people who are using the unstable situation for their own means. There are people who kill other people, hoping that the blame will be actually based on Inkatha and the ANC's rivalry. It does happen. That's what the ANC call the third force.
What is the third force?
The third force is supposed to be some people who are organizing this violence nicely, neatly, and with brutality. The ANC believes there are some people, but they believe that the third force is merely from the government's security forces that supplies the people with arms to do the killing, that supplies the people with money to travel around the country. There have been many examples of that, but there's not been any tangible proof that this is the case. And many people in South Africa believe there is a force that is actually perpetrating the violence.
So the people who believe there's a third force believe that that force exists to keep black people divided and weakened?
Indeed. Also to delay the end of apartheid, and also to make sure that the ANC is demoralized. Indeed, they have succeeded because the ANC is not the powerful ANC that we saw when it came back from exile in 1990. Mr. Mandela and everyone in the ANC agrees that now they are going to struggle to get 55% of the vote, whereas even people in South Africa said if we had had an election a year after Mandela was freed, the ANC could have mustered 75 to 80%. Now, Mr. Mandela says they are going to fight for 55%. He also said that if the violence is not stopped, 40% of people in Natal and the Johannesburg area, which is the most heavily populated area, are going to stay away from the elections. 40% of the people, eligible voters, are going to stay away from the polls.
You must find it very upsetting to see black South Africans fighting with each other at a time when I'm sure you hoped that things would be much more positive, where blacks would be uniting and just a much more positive state, ready to vote in the elections.
Indeed. I sometimes actually wonder why keep on being a journalist and see all these kind of things. Sometimes I wonder people who are not doing this sleep nicely than I am. Sometimes I wonder what can I do to help. When you come across, I remember 2 weeks ago, not 2 weeks ago, about a month ago, about 25 people were killed in one single massacre. People were waiting for a taxi. People were waiting to board transport back home from work. And I arrived there, and I saw all these bodies there. I was just dumbfounded. I couldn't do anything. I couldn't react. I just stood there. And my other colleagues were interviewing people. I just stood there. I couldn't move. I just wondered why this kind of thing has to happen now. And again, that thought came to my mind. And I said to myself, there was a lady who had been shot, and she was bleeding there, and she was dead. And she was still clutching her handbag. And on the other hand, she was clutching bread, a loaf of bread. Now, later on, I said to myself, now, this woman went to work this morning, and then she was on her way home, and she went into a restaurant. She bought bread for her children. She wouldn't make it. She's not there. She's not going to make it. And I imagined her children waiting for her, not knowing that their mother has died.
I can't help but think, listening to you talk, that I think for a lot of Americans, we think, oh, it's good news in South Africa. Sanctions have been lifted.
Yes.
Elections coming up in April. They're making such progress. Isn't it great? And I'm talking to you, and all I'm hearing is about severed feet and exhumed bodies that are set on fire. It sounds absolutely terrible.
Yes. But then, again, I have to emphasize that although all these things happen, there's been a lot of progress as far as the convergence of ideas between politicians and political groups. There's been a lot of progress as far as negotiating a new constitution is concerned. There's a very good relationship between the government and the ANC. Mr. Mandela and Mr. de Klerk are now joint winners of the Nobel Peace Prize. Although we in South Africa regard that prize as an encouragement rather than them having done something for peace, it's good news for the country. Look, what I'm telling you, the bleak picture that I just painted is really about people on the ground who have not benefited from this process, who have not benefited from this glowing praise that Mr. Mandela and Mr. de Klerk are getting, who have not benefited from the lifting of sanctions and are waiting for something to happen to them. I talk to a lot of people every day who say to me, where are all these leaders that will come to us and say we must vote for them? We are dying. We are the ones who are dying here. I talk to a lot of people who are saying, oh God, sanctions have been lifted. Where are jobs now? We are unemployed. And what I'm trying to tell you is that whatever is going on in the negotiating process will benefit the country at the end, but not now. Because people are dying. The country is in deep recession. One in every two black South Africans are unemployed. And the whole country is gripped with fear, although I wouldn't say the whole country is sort of gripped with violence, because Natal and the Johannesburg area are the hardest hit, you see, and they constitute 20% of the country. The other 20% is peaceful, but every now and then they watch Johannesburg and Natal in flames, you see. Now, when Mr. Mandela says to you, if we don't do something about this, 40% of the people will stay away from the pause. This is really bad news, because Natal and Johannesburg constitutes about, well, maybe 40% of the population. And although the other people in other provinces and areas are living peacefully, I don't think in their minds they're very peaceful, because they can watch all these things happening. I don't think they will also dare walk to the polling booth there on April the 27th, because they say, oh, what about if I get shot?
That's what they're afraid of. They're afraid,
yeah,
that they'll be shot by who?
Oh, whoever will be trying to scuttle the entire peace process, you see. I have a lot of friends also who tell me that they don't think they'll be voting. Imagine, I haven't voted for 36 years of my life.
For your whole life.
Let's say, well, I was supposed to vote when I'm 18 anyway. I'm 37 now. For 18 years, I qualified to vote. I haven't voted. Now, this is supposed to be the biggest exciting opportunity of my life. And yet people are not going to take it. I'm not going to take that offer.
If you're just joining us, my guest is journalist Rich Mkando, and he covers South Africa for Reuters. He's lived in South Africa all his life, and he's written a new book called Reporting South Africa. We're going to take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. South African journalist Rich Mkando is my guest. I'm interested in what your life has been like as a black journalist in South Africa. You started writing during the years of apartheid.
Mm-hmm.
Now, of course, you've seen a lot of that change. You've written both for South African papers and for Reuters, which is a wire service based in England. So when you started, how old were you when you started writing, and what kind of restrictions were you up against that your white colleagues were not?
Well, I guess I was, I think, at 27 when I started writing. That is 9 years ago, I think. And I worked for the Rand Daily Mail, which was an anti-apartheid liberal newspaper, white-owned, respected worldwide for its vociferous fight against apartheid. And it was tough then. It was tough because apartheid, those were the dark days of apartheid. And the government was passing law after law restricting coverage of certain issues. Basically, what they wanted to do was to outlaw any reports about black dissent against apartheid. So it was very tough for us to work under those conditions. But I think we made it. I can give you quite a number of examples about these kind of laws. You couldn't describe what the police were doing. You couldn't take pictures of police action. Basically, police were given the free hand to do anything, either in front of the media or even if the media was not there. You couldn't report or even quote any ANC leaders who were outside the country. What we depended on was either even reports from outside coming in couldn't be printed by local newspapers. And unfortunately, the scope of newspapers in South Africa was very limited. There are only four or five big companies that own English newspapers. So not many. There were not many of them. But I think under these circumstances, we did our best. I remember very well that I was in Washington when sanctions were imposed against South Africa. And I was there in the press gallery watching these guys voting yes or no for the imposition of sanctions. And I was outside during the celebrations. And I remember very well, I wouldn't forget that. And one of the ANC people in Washington came to me and said, "Look, I just want to congratulate you guys. You've done a wonderful job because it was because of you, the media, that the outside world got to know about what's going on in South Africa." And indeed, despite the fact that I was then working for a local newspapers, I was part-time working for Reuters because white journalists find it very difficult and dangerous to go into the townships. So I was sort of a freelancer for Reuters. And they liked my work. That's why they actually employed me a year after I came back to South Africa. When I changed from local to international news business, I didn't know what I was doing. But I don't regret it now because I know I played a very, very prominent role in trying to get the people to know what's going on in South Africa. By the way, the government also realized that although they banned, outlawed any reports in South Africa about police action, about government action, they had forgotten to impose such restrictions against the international media. That's what they then turned attention to. They deported many journalists, including Michael Parks of the Los Angeles Times and Steve Mufson, then of Newsweek, and many others were deported. So the picture was coming from the outside of South Africa being up in flames. So I think indeed we have played a very, very prominent role. And even people in South Africa accept that that we have played a very prominent role in exposing the injustices of apartheid.
Rich Mkando reports on South Africa for Reuters. His new book is called Reporting South Africa.